The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today, from the December 2nd, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I'll read two stories about hurricanes and families. One by David Sedaris, which takes place in North Carolina, and one in Ireland by Roddy Doyle. I'll begin today with a story from the personal history section entitled Hurricane Season on Storms, Repairs, and Families by David Sedaris. Grow up in North Carolina, and it's hard to get too attached to a beach house, knowing as you do that it's on borrowed time. If the hurricane doesn't come this autumn, well, it'll likely come the next. The one that claimed our place, the C section, in September of 2018 was Florence. Hugh was devastated, while my only thought was, what's with the old-fashioned names? Irma, Agnes, Bertha, Floyd? They sound like finalists in a pinochle tournament. Isn't it time for Hurricanes Madison and Schuyler? Where's Latrice? Or Category 4, Fredante? Florence, it was said, gave new meaning to the word namaste along the North Carolina coast. Are you going to evacuate? Namaste. Hugh and I were in London when the hurricane hit and was followed almost immediately by a tornado. Our friend Burmy owns a house, the dark side of the dune, not far from ours, and went over to check on the C-section as soon as people were allowed back onto Emerald Isle. He found our doors wide open, blown open by the wind. A large section of the roof had been ripped off, and the rain that had fallen in the subsequent days had caused the ceilings on both floors to cave in, the water draining, as if the house were a sieve down into the carport. Burmy took pictures, which looked so tawdry I was embarrassed to share them. It seems that rats had been living in the second floor ceilings, so there were our beds speckled with currant-sized turds and tufts of bloated, discolored insulation. All the interior drywall would need to be replaced, as would the roof, of course, along with the doors and windows. We were left with a shell, essentially. Had ours been the only place affected, it might have been easy to have the repairs done. But between the hurricane and the flooding, thousands of homes had been either destroyed or severely damaged, and that was just in North Carolina. Our other house, luckily, was relatively unscathed. It's next door to the C-section, and when it came up for sale in 2016, Hugh disregarded my objections and bought it. His argument was that if we didn't get it, someone would most likely tear it down and construct the sort of McMansion that has become the rule on Emerald Isle, rather than the exception. The size of these new houses was one thing. 8 bedrooms were common, spread over 3 or 4 stories. But what came with them, and what you really didn't want next door to you, was a swimming pool. What happened to us 10 years ago, moaned my friend Lynette, who owns an older, traditionally sized cottage up the street from us. Now all we hear is Marco Polo, Marco Polo, over and over and over. It's like torture. The place that Hugh bought is ancient by Emerald Isle standards, built in 1972. It's a single-story, 4-bedroom, perched on stilts and painted a shade of pink that's almost carnal. Like the C-section, it's right on the ocean, but unlike the C-section, it's rented out to vacationers. At first, Hugh went through an agency, but now he does it himself, through a number of websites. Our friend Lee across the street rents out his place, almost paradise, as do most of our Emerald Isle neighbors, and all of them have stories to tell. People leave with the pillows and coat hangers. People grill on the wooden decks. They bring dogs, regardless of whether or not you allow them. And small children, meaning all sorts of things get flushed down the toilets, seashells, doll clothes, dice. And of course, people complain about absolutely everything. The TV only gets 90 channels. There's something missing. There's some missing paint on the picnic table. Lee once got a comment from a renter that read, quote, "I was shocked by your outdoor shower," end quote. "I was thinking, how surprising can it be?" he told me. "I mean, you're at the beach, for God's sake." And then I went out to wash up, and when I touched the handle for the hot water, I got thrown clear across the room. Hugh bought the second house with everything in it, and although it's a bit heavy on the white wicker, the furniture is far from awful. He drew the line at the artwork, though. It was standard fare for a beach house, garish pictures of sailboats and sunsets, signs reading, "If you're not barefoot, you're overdressed," and "Old fishermen never die. They just smell that way." If he wanted to, Hugh could work as a professional forger. That's how good he is at copying paintings. So for the rental house, he reproduced a number of Picassos, including La Bannière from 1937, which depicts two naked women knee-deep in the water with a third person looking on. The figures are abstracted, almost machine-like, and cement-colored, positioned against a sapphire sea and an equally intense sky. Hugh did three others, all beach-related, and got a comment from a renter saying that, although the house was comfortable enough, the artwork, and she put it in quotes, was definitely not family-friendly. As the mother of young children, she had taken the paintings down during her stay and said that if he wanted her to return, he'd definitely have to rethink his decor, as if they were Hustler centerfolds. "Can you believe that woman?" you said, almost a year after the hurricane hit, when we arrived to spend a week on Emerald Isle. It was August. The C-section was still under construction, so we stayed at the rental house, which he was calling the Pink House, for reasons I could not for the life of me understand. "It's such a boring name," I argued. "Oh, it really is," my sister Gretchen agreed. She'd pulled up an hour before we had and was dressed in a fudge-colored tankini. Her long hair is going silver and was gathered in a burger-sized bun. Not quite on the back of her head, but not on top either. She had turned 60 earlier that week and looked as if she were made of well-burnished leather, the effect of age and aggressive year-round tanning. The skin between her throat and her chest had gone crepey, and it bothered me to notice it. I cannot bear watching my sisters get old. It just seems cruel. They were all such beauties. "Calling this the Pink House is just nothing," she said. The best name, in my opinion, considering that the rental was next to the C-section, was a choice between the Amniotic Shack and Canker Shores. Both had been suggested by a third party and were far better than what I'd come up with. "And what was that?" Gretchen asked, opening a cabinet in search for a coffee cup. "Country Pride Strong Family Peppermill," I told her. "Ah, not that again," Hugh said. "Oh, it's not a pun, but I think it has a nice ring to it." Hugh opened the refrigerator and then reached for the trash can. Renters aren't supposed to leave things behind, but they do, and none of their condiments were meeting his approval. "Well, it sounds like you just went to the grocery store and wrote down words." "Well, that's exactly what I did," I told him. "Well, too bad. It's my house, and I'll call it what I want to." "But," he tossed a bottle of orange salad dressing into the garbage, "but nothing but out." "C-R-A-B," Gretchen mouthed. I nodded in agreement and made pinching motions with my hands. It can sometimes be tricky having Hugh around my family. "What is his problem?" each of my siblings has asked me at one time or another, usually flopping down on my bed during a visit. "What is whose problem?" I always say. But it's just a formality. I know who they're talking about. I've heard you yell at everyone, even my father. Get out of my kitchen is pretty common, as is use a plate. And did I say you could start eating? I'd like to be loyal when they complain about him. I'd like to say, I'm sorry, but that's my boyfriend of almost 30 years you're talking about. But I've always felt that my first loyalty is to my family, and so I whisper, isn't it horrible? How can you stand it, they ask. I don't know, I say, though of course I do. I love Hugh. Not the moody Hugh who slams doors and shouts at people. That one I merely tolerate. But he's not like that all the time. Just enough to have earned him a reputation. Why did you yell at Lisa, I asked, the year that three of my sisters joined us for Christmas at our home in Sussex? Because she came to the dinner table with a coat on. So? It made her look like she wasn't staying, he said, like she was going to leave as soon as her ride pulled up. And? I said, though I knew exactly what he was saying. It was Christmas dinner, and it's a slippery slope. One year, you wear a down coat at the table, and the next you're dressed in a sweatsuit, eating cold spaghetti out of a pan in front of the TV. My sisters can say what they will about Hugh's moodiness, but no one can accuse him of letting himself go, or even of taking shortcuts, especially during the holidays, when it's homemade everything from the eggnog to the piglet with an apple in its mouth. There's a tree. There are his German great-grandmother's cookies. He will spend 4 days in an apron listening to the Messiah, and that's the way it is, goddammit. Similarly, he makes the beach feel the way it's supposed to. A few years back, he designed a spiral-shaped outdoor shower at the C-section that we found ourselves using even in the winter. He grills seafood every night and serves lunch on the deck overlooking the ocean. He makes us ice cream with fruit sold at an outdoor stand by the people who grew it, and he mixes drinks at cocktail hour. It's just that he's, well, he's Hugh. When I get mad at someone, it's usually a reaction to something he or she said or did. Hugh's anger is more like the weather, something you open your door and step into. There's no dressing for it, and neither is there any method for predicting it. A few months after we met, for example, he and I ran into an old friend of mine at a play. This was in New York in 1991. We thought we'd all go out to eat, and then Hugh offered to cook at his apartment. Somewhere between the theater and Canal Street, his mood darkened. There was no reason. It was like the wind shifting direction. The making of dinner involved a lot of muttering, and when my friend sat down to eat, his chair gave way, causing him to tumble onto the floor. I apologized, saying that the chair was already broken, and Hugh contradicted me. No, it wasn't. Why would you say that? I asked after my friend had hobbled home. Because it wasn't broken, he said. Oh, it doesn't matter, I explained. The point was to make him feel less embarrassed. Too bad, you said. I can't hide who I am. Well, it's really important to try, I told him. I mean, like, really, really important. Let me ask you two a question, Hugh said to Gretchen and me on our first afternoon at the Pink House in August. He opened the sliding glass door to the deck and invited us to sit on the rocking chairs out there. The nails that held them together had been weeping rust under the unpainted wood for so long that I put a towel down so as not to stain my white shorts and got snapped at for it. Now, please. I took a seat. Ready. Okay. Do you think those are rickety? That's what the renter who hated the paintings called them. I settled in and swayed as much going side to side as I did going back and forth. Yes, I said. Rickety is probably the best word for this, possibly followed by kindling. This one, too, Gretchen said. Well, you're just spoiled, you told us. There's nothing at all wrong with those rocking chairs. And he stormed back into the house, and I heard the click that meant he had locked us out. God damn it, Gretchen said. My cigarettes are in there. Lisa and Paul and Amy couldn't make it to the beach this time. It was sad being on the island without them, but at least it left fewer people for Hugh to crab at. If you want to raise your voice to someone, you might consider the contractors, I said in the living room the following morning, looking next door at our empty driveway and not hearing what I heard coming from other houses, the racket of hammers and skill saws. Well, why don't you call them? Hugh asked. Well, I filled out all the insurance forms. I see'd all the bills and taxes. So how about you take care of something for a change? I didn't respond, but just sighed, knowing he wasn't serious. The last thing Hugh wants is me taking care of something. I wouldn't have paid him any mind, but Gretchen was in the room. I don't like seeing my relationship through her eyes. That said, I do like seeing my family from Hugh's vantage point. To him, we're like dolls cut from flypaper, each one of us connected to the other and dotted with foul little corpses. What is with men adjusting their balls all the time? Gretchen asked, staring down at her phone. Are you talking about someone specifically? Hugh asked. The guys that I work with, she said. The landscaping crews. They just can't keep their hands away from their crotches. Well, it could be a heat rash, I suggested, adding that touching your testicles in public is now illegal in Italy. Men did it to ward off bad luck, apparently. Gretchen said, turning back to her phone. I was in a meeting a few weeks back, and when I took one of my shoes off, a roach ran out. It must have been hiding in there when I got dressed that morning. Well, what does that have to do with anything? Hugh asked. I rolled my eyes. Doesn't matter. It's always time for a good story. Your family, he said, like we were a bad thing. That afternoon, I watched him swim out into the ocean. Gretchen and I were on the beach together, and I remembered a young woman earlier in the summer who'd had a leg bitten off, as well as a few fingers. Squinting at the horizon as Hugh grew smaller and smaller, I said that if the sharks did get him, I just hoped they'd spare his right arm. That way he can still kind of cook and access our accounts online. It's hard to imagine Gretchen's boyfriend crabbing at anyone. She and Marshall have been together almost as long as Hugh and I have, and I can't think of a gentler guy. The same can be said of Paul's wife, Kathy. My brother-in-law, Bob, might get crotchety every so often, but when he snaps at Lisa for, say, balancing a glass of grape juice on the arm of a white sofa, we usually think, well, she kind of deserved it. Amy's been single since the mid-90s, but I never heard her last boyfriend, a funny and handsome asthmatic, yell at anyone, even when he had good reason to. Gretchen and I had been on the beach for all of 20 minutes before she did what she always does, eventually. I went online recently and read all sorts of horrible comments about you, she said lazily, as if the shape of a passing cloud had reminded her of it. I don't know where she gets the idea that anyone would want to hear things like this. Gretchen, there's a reason I don't Google myself. I really don't want to. A lot of people just can't stand you. I know, I said. It's a consequence of putting stuff out there. You're going to get reactions. That doesn't mean I have to regard them all. Geez, I thought, sprinting back to the house over the scorching sand and wondering which was worse, getting snapped at by Hugh or having to endure what Gretchen was doling out. Although it's true that I don't read reviews or look myself up, I do answer my mail. A few months earlier, I'd been given 230 letters sent to me in the care of my publishing house. I had responded to 180 already and brought the remaining 50 to the beach, where I'd figured I'd see to 10 a day. Most were just what I'd always wanted, kind words from strangers. Every now and then, though, a complaint would come along. I'd like to say I brushed them off, and I guess I do in time. For days, though, and sometimes months, I'll be bothered. For example, a woman sent me her ticket stubs, plus her parking receipt, demanding that I reimburse her. She and her husband had attended a reading and apparently objected to my material. "I thought you were better than that," she scolded, which always confuses me. First off, better than what? I mean, a clean show is fine, but no finer than a filthy one. Me? I like a nice balance. That aside, who doesn't want to hear about a man who shoved a coat hanger up his rectum? How can you not find that fascinating? What kind of person are you? I wanted to write back. Sometimes, after a hard day of angry letters or emails, after having an essay rejected or listening to Gretchen tell me how much a woman she works with thinks I suck, I'll go to Hugh and beg him to say something nice about me. "Like what?" he'll ask. "I shouldn't have to tell you. Think of something." "I can't right now," he'll say. "I'm in the middle of making dinner." As if I'd ask him to name all the world capitals in an alphabetical order. I feel as though I'm always complimenting him. "You look so handsome tonight. What a great meal you made. You're so smart, so well-read," etc. It's effortless, really. "I don't want to give you a fat head," he'll tell me when I ask for something in return. "My head is like the size of an onion. I'm begging you, please enlarge it." He says I get enough praise already, but it's not the same thing. "Okay," he'll say finally. "You're persistent. How's that?" I like coming to Emerald Isle in May. It's not too hot then, and most everyone in my family can take a week off. Ditto at Thanksgiving. August, though, is definitely something I do for Hugh, a sacrifice. The heat that month is brutal, and the humidity is so high my glasses fog up. At home in Sussex, I'd happily be walking 22 miles a day, but at Emerald Isle, at the height of summer, I'm lucky to get 15 in, and even then I really have to force myself. I don't like to aimlessly wander, especially in a place where thunderstorms can appear without warning. I need a destination. So I generally go to a coffee shop near the grocery store, usually with a couple of letters to answer. Back and forth I'll walk, making three or more trips a day. When Hugh and I lived in Normandy, he heard a local woman telling a friend about a mentally challenged man she often saw marching past her house. "He wore headphones," she said, "and looked at pictures while talking to himself." That, of course, was me. But they weren't pictures I was holding. They were index cards with that day's 10 new French vocabulary words on them. In Sussex, not long ago, an acquaintance approached me to share a similar story. Again, I was identified as mentally challenged, this time because I was picking up trash and muttering to myself. Only I wasn't muttering. I was repeating phrases from my Learn to Speak Japanese or Swedish or Polish audio program. "The woman who saw you said, 'I just hope no one tries to take advantage of him,' the acquaintance told me." On Emerald Isle this August, it was German I was muttering. I might have picked up an occasional bit of trash, but I wasn't carrying any equipment, just Ziploc bags of hot dogs or thick bologna to feed the snapping turtles in the canal. We'd been at the beach for 4 days when I noticed a great many ant colonies in the dirt bordering the sidewalk between the strip mall the CVS is in and the one the grocery store is in. The ants were cinnamon-colored, hundreds of thousands of them, all racing about, searching for something to eat. "Excuse me," I said that afternoon to the guy behind the counter at the hardware store. "I was wanting to feed some ants and wonder what you think they might like. How would they feel about bananas?" The man's face and neck were deeply creased from age and the sun. "Bananas?" He took off his glasses and then put them back on. "Nah, I'd go with candy. Ants like that pretty good." So I bought a bag of gummy worms from beside the register, bit them into thirds, and, on my way back to the house, distributed them among the various colonies as evenly as I could. It made me happy to think of the workers presenting their famished queens with sugar and possibly being rewarded for it. "You're out there feeding ants candy?" Hugh said that night at the table when we were all discussing our day. "They don't need your help, and neither do the stupid turtles. You mess things up by feeding them. You hurt them is what you do." It wasn't what he said that concerned me, but rather his tone, which, again, I wouldn't have noticed if my sister weren't there. "Well, they seem pretty happy to me," I said. Gretchen patted my hand. "Don't listen to Hugh. He doesn't know the S word about being an ant." This was a relatively short beach trip. Renters were arriving on Saturday, so the three of us had to have the house clean and be out by 10 a.m. Gretchen left a little bit earlier than we did, and though I was sorry to see her go, it was a relief to escape her judgment regarding the life I have built with Hugh. As it was, whenever anything good happened during that week, whenever he was cheerful or thoughtlessly kind, I wanted to say, "See, this is what my relationship is like. This." It was a 3-hour drive to Raleigh. I had work to do, so while Hugh drove, I sat in the back seat. "Just for a little while," I said. I must have fallen asleep, though. After waking, I read for a bit, and the next thing I knew, the car wasn't moving. "What's going on?" I asked, too lazy to sit up and look out the window. "I don't know," Hugh said. "An accident, maybe." I righted myself and was just attempting to hop into the front seat when Hugh advanced and tapped the car in front of us. "Now see what you made me do?" "Me?" I don't know anything about cars, but the one he'd hit was bigger than ours and white. The driver was husky and pissed-off-looking, with the sort of large, watery eyes I'd expect to find behind glasses. "Did you just hit me?" he asked, walking toward us. He bent to examine his bumper, which seemed to be made of plastic and had a pale mark on it, possibly put there by us. Hugh rolled down his window. "I maybe did, but just a little." The man glared at what he probably assumed was an Uber driver making extra money by taking people to the airport, or wherever that gap-toothed dope in the back seat was headed. He gave his bumper another once-over, and then the traffic started moving. Someone honked, and the man got back into his car. "Hit him again," I said to Hugh, "but harder this time. We need to show him who's boss." "Will you please shut up," he said. "As a favor to me, please." When we first got the news that Hurricane Florence had all but destroyed the C-section, I felt nothing. Part of my indifference was that I'd expected this to happen. It was inevitable. Then, too, I wasn't as attached to the place as he was. I wasn't the one who'd be contacting the insurance company. I wouldn't be dropping everything to fly to North Carolina. It wouldn't be me picking turds off our beds or finding a contractor. In that sense, I could afford to feel nothing. After looking at the pictures that Bermie had sent, I shrugged and went for a walk. At dusk, I returned and found Hugh in our bedroom, curled up with his face in his hands. "My house," he sobbed, his shoulders quaking. "Well, one of your houses, I said, thinking of Florence's other victims. Some, like Hugh, were crying under beds, far from the affected area, while others were on fold-out sofas in sleeping bags, in the back seats of cars, or on cots laid out like circuitry in public school gymnasiums. People who thought they were far enough inland to be safe, who'd had real belongings in their now ruined houses, things that were dear to them and irreplaceable. The hardest hit victims lost actual people, mates or friends or family members swept away and swallowed by floodwaters. Then again, this was something of a pattern for Hugh. So many of the houses he'd lived in growing up had been destroyed. In Beirut, Mogadishu, Kinshasa. He's actually sort of bad luck that way. I put my arms around him and said the things that were expected of me. We'll rebuild and it will all be fine. Better, actually. You'll see. This was how I always imagined myself in a relationship. The provider. The rock. The reassuring voice of wisdom. I had to catch myself from saying, I've got you, which is what people say on TV now when they're holding a distraught person. It's a nice sentiment. But culturally speaking, there was only a 5-minute period when you could say this without sounding lame, and it has long passed. I do have him, though. Through other people's eyes, the two of us might not make sense. But that works in reverse as well. I have a number of friends who are in long-term relationships I can't begin to figure out. But what do I know? What is Gretchen or Lisa or Amy? They see me getting scolded from time to time, getting locked out of my own house. But where are they in the darkening rooms when a close friend dies or rebels or rebels storm the embassy? When the wind picks up and the floodwaters rise, when you realize you'd give anything to make that other person stop hurting, if only so he can tear your head off again, and you can forgive and forget again. On and on, hopefully. And then on and on and on. And now, from the fiction section, a short story. The Curfew by Roddy Doyle. He was walking back up the street from the seafront when he looked up and saw the woman coming at him. He'd been watching the leaves. Ex-Hurricane Ophelia was heading toward Dublin, and the leaves were blowing the wrong way. They were passing him, dashing by him, rolling up the hill. The curfew would be starting in half an hour. He'd been giving out about it earlier, before his wife left for work. Do they think there's a civil war? It's only a bit of weather. But actually, he liked the drama of it. Even now, walking home, striding, he was striding, a man on a mission. He felt involved, ready, ahead of the coming catastrophe. It was doing him good. He was carrying drugs in a paper bag, but he felt like a man who didn't need them. He'd already folded the garden chairs and put them away. He'd tucked the wheelie bins well in under the hedge. He'd put candles around the house just in case. He'd done other stuff, too. He was all set. He liked the word curfew. He liked the daft importance of it. There'd be army tenders patrolling the streets, amplified voices warning citizens to stay in out of the rain. Get back inside, you'll catch yourself death. There'd be bursts of gunfire. Blood would flow in the gutters, downhill, while the leaves skipped and swirled up the hill. He didn't have to visit his mother. He didn't have to work. He didn't have to tell his wife about himself and the widow's block. He'd be safe inside the curfew for a while. Bring it on, he said aloud. There was no one else on the street. Blow winds, crack your effing cheeks. Then he looked up and saw the woman. She was wearing one of those baby slings, and the baby was facing out, looking his way right under its mother's chin. There were two faces coming, staring straight at him. It wasn't a baby. Well, what should I do? He'd asked. Nothing, the doctor had said. Nothing? He'd had a health check a couple of weeks before. a routine check offered by his health insurer, free. Heart, prostate, eyes, ears. He couldn't remember what else, and all he could really recall was the prostate test. The doctor was a woman, and he hadn't cared. He lay on his side and grabbed his knees as she'd told him to, and he'd been fine with it, and pleased, even when he saw her dropping the latex gloves into a bin as she told him he could sit up again. He'd felt modern. It's something he'd never tell his daughters about, but he would still remember as they lectured him on gender identity or the glass ceiling in Irish universities. "I know what you're talking about," he'd be tempted to say. "A woman doctor had her finger up my arse, and she was thoroughly professional." He loved his daughter's lectures. A week after the checkup, his phone had vibrated in his pocket. He didn't know the number on the screen. "Hello?" It was the doctor. "How are you today?" she asked. "Grand," he said. "Yourself?" She told him he had coronary artery disease. "Oh. Well, you shouldn't worry," she said. "Well, what does it involve?" he asked. "Exactly." She told him that there were high levels of cholesterol in his arteries. One of them was 70% blocked.
70%?
"Yes." "Well, that's nearly three quarters," he said. "We'll need to do further tests," she said. "And again, there's no reason or no need to be worrying yourself unduly. It's called the widow's block, by the way." She sounded cheerful. He liked that. "The blocked arteries?" he asked. "Yes," she said, "the condition. That's what they call it, the widow's block." He liked the sound of it. The fact that he had a wife helped. It made sense somehow. It was almost noble. He was taking the pain for her. There was no pain. There had never been any pain. Not an ache. Not a twinge. But now he had a heart problem. A heart condition. An effing disease. "What should I do?"
"Nothing."
"Nothing?" "For now," she said, "you're fine. There'll be further tests and we'll organize an angiogram. Stents might be wise. But nothing for now. And don't Google."
"Okay."
"That way lies madness," she said.
"What's an angiogram?" he asked.
"Well, you can Google that one," she said. "That's just information." He liked her. He couldn't remember what she'd look like.
"Can I Google stents?"
"You can, but leave it at that." He put his phone back in his pocket and continued working. He wrote angiogram on an envelope. He wrote stents. He wrote artery and coronary and nothing and disease. It wasn't a baby in the sling. It was a teddy bear. They, the woman and the bear, had nearly reached him now. He didn't have to move or shift or sway to the left or right, as he often had to when he encountered people coming the opposite way. They were between trees, him and her, so there was plenty of room on the path. A teddy bear. A biggish one. It fit neatly into the sling. A baby-sized bear, a big baby. It was wearing a jumper, and it wasn't new. It was older than any baby who might have owned it. He looked at the woman, although he didn't want to. He didn't want to see her looking back at him. He didn't want to be caught. She looked straight ahead. He felt like a spectator watching her through a window. He wasn't there, near her, right beside her. She passed. He didn't look back. He kept going up to the house. The curfew was coming. The ex-hurricane was coming. He wanted to check the wheelies again. He wanted to make sure all the windows were fastened. He wanted to get off the street. She didn't look like a mother. He didn't know what that meant, really. He could hear himself telling his wife this, and she'd ask him. She was thin, he'd say. She didn't look like a woman who'd recently been pregnant. They'd had four kids of their own. He lived in the world of babies and pregnant women. He wasn't a total idiot. She was skinny, he'd say. Very unusually skinny. Her face was, the word was there waiting for him, empty. Her face was empty, he'd say. Vacant, expressionless. She walked right past me, he'd say, like I wasn't there. He got his keys out. He'd have the right one ready when he got to the front door.
He remembered the weight of his youngest daughter, Cleona, in one of those slings. They hadn't had one. They might not have been invented yet for the other kids, the boy and the two older girls. They'd had a backpack thing, like a rucksack for carrying them. He hated the backpack. 6 or 7 years of having the thing on his back, not being able to see the baby as he walked. He'd hated it until the child was old enough to grab his hair or his collar, and he'd know it was fine back there. There was a day in Kerry on a beach years ago. The eldest, Chiara, was the baby in the backpack. He'd been up early that morning, and it was his turn. He'd put her in the backpack, he kissed her forehead, hoisted her onto his back, and gone walking. He hadn't even checked the weather or looked out the window. If you're able to see Brandon in the evening, you'll be grand, some old lad with a peaked cap had told him. And he'd seen the mountain the night before. He was sure he had. So he'd fed Chiara, shoved a slice of bread into his mouth, and walked out the back door of the house they were renting for the week. There was a dead whale on the beach, they'd been told when they were eating in the local pub. He couldn't remember the name of the pub or the name of the beach. He walked down a lane, crossed the main road, and 10 more minutes along a narrow line of tarmac to the beach. Chara was 8 months old, and he hadn't started doing what he did later with the others, talking to them over his shoulder, talking to himself, asking questions they wouldn't be answering. It was early, about 7, he thought. He'd done that thing, taken his watch off when the holiday started, but it was already hot. He reached the sand. The beach was empty, no one else on it at all. The whale, he knew, was to the left. About 20 minutes along the strand, they'd said, "You won't effin' miss it, sure." He started walking along the hard sand at the edge of the sea, and somewhere 10 minutes in, he decided that Chara was dead, and he kept walking until he could see the well and smell it. He was afraid to stop, submit to the feeling, the certainty he knew was false. He found it hard to identify that man as himself now, the Egypt stepping over the sand, the mad logic of parenthood. He'd stopped when he knew he was smelling the whale, his destination. He couldn't remember the smell. He couldn't remember the words he used to describe it when he got back to the house. Atrocious, probably. Effing atrocious. Unbelievable. Ah, Jesus. He didn't know. He knew it had been terrible enough to halt him. He could feel it on his skin, adding oil to his sweat. He was about 50 yards from the carcass. He stopped looking at it. He wasn't interested. It was different shades of gray. That was all he remembered. He took off the backpack. He parked it on the sand. Char was fine. She was sleeping. He'd remembered to put her sun hat on before he left the house. Her neck was properly covered. He'd never told anyone that he thought she was dead, that he carried her dead for 20 minutes. She was in Vancouver now. She'd be Skyping him later. He hadn't thought of it in years, that day on the beach. He'd never tell her. He didn't know why not. He was at the front door, but he stepped off the porch and walked back across the small garden to the wheelie bins, brown, green, and black, and the hedge. He looked again, made sure they were tucked in under the lip of the hedge, that they wouldn't be lifted by the wind that was coming. He pushed them in farther. He didn't know what else to do with them. He could bring them into the house, but he wouldn't. He didn't want his wife to find them lined up in the hall. Maybe he'd look out the bedroom window and see them spinning up like Dorothy's house in The Wizard of Oz. Something to tell Chiara when they were talking. The brown one landed on the old witch across the street. He let himself in. The house was still empty, the way he'd left it. His wife would be home soon. She'd have to be. She'd have to get home before the curfew kicked in, or else she'd be trapped in a spotlight, shot on the front step by some kid in the army. He went down through the house to the kitchen. He took the tablets, the 3 slim boxes, out of the chemist's paper bag. His new pills, his regimen. He put them standing in a row. They looked unfinished like that. He needed more boxes. Stonehenge. He could make a joke of it when he was telling her later. He got his reading glasses from the table. He'd left them on top of the book he was reading. He always did that. The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, America. They could all F off till he had taken his pills and found out what it was that he was taking. He loved carrying the youngest girl, Cleona. Any excuse, almost literally any excuse, he'd slide her into the sling, her face looking out at the world, and go off to the shops, towns, the seafront, nowhere. He'd love the weight there against his chest and the fact that he saw what she was seeing. He could feel her excitement, her legs hopping, the approaching faces breaking into smiles, for her and then for him. She's gorgeous. She's a dote. Proud of his daughter, proud of himself, Cleona in the sling, Connor in the buggy, Chara and Maeve on either side holding the handles. Down through town, through the crowds, Henry Street, Grafton Street, people made way. He never lost a child. The doctor had sent him leaflets in the post. The fats of life, the lowdown on high cholesterol, was one. He wasn't fat. He hadn't read it yet. He glanced at it. There was an article about some smiling actor from Fair City who'd taken control of his cholesterol, and a page called Recipe Corner. There was another leaflet, Angioplasty and Coronary Stenting. There were no pictures in that one. Definitions, questions, answered, a detachable consent form at the back. He hadn't read that one either. He took his glasses off the book and went back to Stonehenge. He listened for whistling wind, falling branches, roof slates decapitating pensioners. He remembered Hurricane Charley in 1986, he thought it was. He'd sat on his bed all night and waited for the windows to fly in on top of him, shred the curtains, impale him against the wall. He'd lived alone then. It was the last time he'd felt physically frightened. He thought that was true. That was more than 30 years ago. He looked at the three boxes. The maximum dose, she'd said the cardiologist this morning when he'd met her, to be on the safe side. Okay. One piece of advice, yes, don't Google, she'd said. Your colleague said that as well. Good, she said. You know enough for now. You'll pick up more as we go along. She was looking at him over her glasses, as if she'd stopped being just a doctor and had become his new friend. He wondered later, when he was looking at the scrambled eggs he'd ordered in the cafe across from the hospital, and the little portion of silver-foiled butter for the toast, if that was him seeing her like that, or if it was her, part of her training or her personality. He'd taken the advice. He hadn't Googled coronary artery disease. He looked at the boxes. He picked up the biggest one. Rosuvastatin, Teva Pharma. It sounded like a star or a planet. 40 milligrams, the maximum dose, the cardiologist had said. That fact had impressed him. We need to get the cholesterol right down to where it should be. Okay. May cause dizziness, a label on the box said. He picked up one of the other boxes. The same thing. May cause dizziness. If affected, do not drive or operate machinery. Did that include his laptop? Or the printer? He'd joke about that, too, when he was telling his wife. I fell off the laptop within seconds of taking those things. There was a leaflet, another leaflet, a death by effing leaflet, inside the box. He unfolded it. It looked a bit like the instructions that came with a washing machine or a blender. Read all of this leaflet carefully before you start taking this medicine because it contains important information for you. He'd never read a leaflet in his life. He thought that was literally true. Decide on a time of day, the cardiologist had told him. Morning, even, evening, or whatever suits. He didn't want to become the man who forgot his pills, or the man who remembered his effing pills. He could hear his father, "Where are my pills? Where did I leave my pills?" The refrain had made the grandkids, his kids, laugh whenever they heard it. They still said it. 10 years after his father's funeral, when they were looking for the salt on the table or a missing sock under a bed, when they were home. He had no grandkids to entertain with his pills. He'd take them, the pills, in the morning with the porridge. He told the cardiologist that he ate porridge every morning.
Oh, that's great. That's helpful.
Three tablets. He'd call them tablets. It was better, more adult than pills.
Where are my tablets? Where did I leave my tablets?
One of each, once a day. Two statins, one aspirin. It wasn't complicated. He'd manage. He'd open the two other boxes. One of the pill cards had the days of the week on serrated squares. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Did that mean he'd have to wait till Monday before he started? If he started now, he'd be taking his Monday pill, his Monday tablet, on a Wednesday. He was effing wild. He stood and got himself a glass of water. He had a look out the kitchen window while he was at it. The branches on the tree next door were waving. They were bending. He could hear a siren off somewhere. He could hear wires whistling. He thought he could.
Where are my pills?
His mother came running, running in her slippers in from the kitchen.
Where are your pills?
That's what I'm bloody asking. Where are they?
She was afraid her husband would fall dead if they didn't find the pills. He'd nearly died. She'd witnessed what could happen. He'd had a heart attack and a triple bypass. He was sitting opposite her at the kitchen table, and then his face was in his soup, and she could see the sweat running off the top of his head.
Like a tap it was, like a waterfall.
She'd phoned him, her son, and told him about the ambulance arriving, the men with the stretcher coming into the house. He'd gone over and driven her to Beaumont, the hospital. He'd looked at her face, the side of her face, the fear, the tension. She didn't look like his mother.
What was the soup? He'd ask her.
Cream of vegetable, she'd said. And she smiled.
Terrible waste.
Finding the pills, knowing exactly where they were, that was the important thing. She'd spent years looking for his pills, keeping his father alive. Until the grandkids started to make a joke of it, and the effing old tyrant decided to join in. But he'd seen it before. It became part of the fun of every Sunday afternoon. He'd seen his mother's face and his father's, her terror and his glee. And before the kids turned it into a weekly bit of fun.
Where are my pills?
He wouldn't have pills. They'd be tablets. He'd know exactly where they were. He would not become his father. He put them on top of the fridge. He typed a note into his phone. Tablets equal fridge. He sat on the bed. He could see the trees on the street and the leaves falling. The chestnut leaves. Huge brown hands. Dropping, floating, caught by the wind and rolling uphill. If he lifted himself slightly, he'd see the wheelies tucked under the hedge. A guy on a bike went past. His hood was full of the hurricane. That was all the drama, the guy on the bike. It was 2:30. He'd listened to the lunchtime news. The west of the country was being chewed by the weather. There were power cuts. Roads made impassable, tin roofs pulled off farm sheds. Outside, here in Dublin, it was a windy day. That was all. He'd been sitting on the bed waiting. He wanted to see a car in the air, 100-year-old oak toppling. He wanted to witness something, anything. And he didn't. The leaves were the story. The fact that nothing was happening. The leaves going the wrong way and the woman with the teddy bear. They were his stories. He lay back on the bed. He turned into whiteness and nothing. No thoughts or things. He slept. He woke with an ache in his right arm. The ache, the pain, had woken him. Was that a sign? Was it pain in the right or the left arm that was a prelude to a heart attack? Or was that the shoulder? He didn't know, and he wouldn't look it up. His arm was numb. Just numb, the way he'd been lying on it. His wife had told him he slept with his arms folded, as if he'd been sitting in a chair and had fallen off it, straight onto the bed. He hadn't believed her.
Not every night, he'd protested.
Yes, every night.
How do you know?
I see you.
But you're awake?
Sometimes.
Why? Jesus, there's a question.
She was there now. She was sitting where he'd been sitting before he fell asleep. He felt her weight on the mattress first and saw her back. She was looking out the window. It was dark.
Anything happening out there?
Not really, she said. Ex-hurricanes aren't what they used to be, like everything else. He'd have to tell her. He had the widow's block, and she was going to be the widow.
You made it home before the curfew, he said.
Just about, she said. He hadn't moved. He didn't want to sit up. He liked looking at her from where he was, where she was. He always liked looking at her.
Have we food? She asked.
Loads.
Grand.
I put candles all around the house, just in case.
We can pretend it's a spa.
She hadn't moved. She hadn't turned to look at him. He leaned out a bit. The numbness in his arm had gone, and put his hand on her back. He felt her move, and her hand touched his, just brushed across it.
Get up, she said. Well, what's the news?
All the action is over in the West, in Galway and Kerry and the other lovely places. The wild Atlantic way.
There you go.
He sat up now. I saw a thing, he said. He told her about the woman he'd seen, the woman with the teddy bear.
That's so sad, she said.
He heard her shoes fall onto the floor, and now she was sitting beside him. He'd tell her in a minute. He'd tell her about his tablets and his heart.
I miss the kids, he said,
and he started to cry.
Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.